Hi, this is Janice Alpert. Welcome to On Purpose, where we interview and discuss and chat with very interesting people who have found their purpose and hope to help you find yours, or if you're on it, to encourage you to stay on it. And today we have an unbelievably, I think, inspirational, informative, plus brilliant guest, Dr. Eben Alexander. Hi, Eben.
Well, hello there, Janice. It's so good to be with you today. Thanks for having me on.
Are you kidding me? Thank you for being on, because when Noah said that you agreed, and just by happenstance, most of the time I don't know that much about my guests. I kind of look them up a little bit before, but I happened to have read your book, Proof of Heaven. So I knew exactly who you were, and on a similar page as you, of your book. But why don't we start off, because the listeners may not know who you are. Tell me a little bit about your growing up and where you're from and a little bit about yourself.
Okay. I grew up in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, went to college in Chapel Hill, then went to medical school at Duke, and then did my residency at Duke, and then went up to Harvard for my main part of my professional career.
Right. I forgot to mention that he's like a neurosurgeon, so we're like really, really smart. So it's very,
it's not rocket science.
It's impressive. All right. But growing up, was your family into like education and science? Like, what was their...
Well, I think the most important thing, I was adopted into the family I grew up in. My older sister was adopted, and then I had two younger sisters in that family who were the biological children of my adoptive parents.
Oh.
So I had this beautiful kind of dance between adoptive and birth family, kind of issues, relationships, connections. And that plays in heavily into my story.
Listeners probably know that my younger son is adopted. I've told that story, which I may tell again if it's appropriate. And I also have a biological, natural, you know, son. Crazy. So I understand that family dynamic already. So,
Yes. And that plays in heavily. I mean, in fact, deep in the backstory of everything that I talk about in my coma journey and my awakening has to do with that adoption history. And that I grew up basically not knowing much about my birth mother. I thought the birth mother was the one who was out there, not a birth father. I thought the birth father, you know, was no longer part of the package. And that's why it was so shocking, as I shared in the book, shared in the book, Proof of Heaven, when in the year 2000, because my older son, Evan the Fourth, was doing a project in family genealogy, I had to reach back down and write another letter to the children's home, expecting to get the same answer as always, you know.
So you had searched, even as a younger person, you had searched for your birth mother.
Right. I had searched for the birth mother, and there were strict laws in North Carolina to prevent that kind of thing. Nobody wanted reunions. So I was always told, forget about it, you know, live your life. And, you know, I was adopted into a wonderful, loving family. So all that was fine.
And you adopted at birth?
It turns out, social services took me at age 11 days. Okay.
Well, that's pretty close.
Born in December of 53, to an unwed 16-year-old mother who wanted to keep me. But they took me for failure to thrive and hospitalized me. But then she couldn't really get me back. She had to sign the papers to let me go. But she wasn't willing to do that until I was 4 months old. So I languished in this baby dorm for 4 months.
Oh, my goodness.
For her to say, yeah, let him go. And that's, you know, part of the background, part of the kind of deep early story of my life, that perceived rejection by my birth mother.
Of course, I understand.
Abandonment wound.
Yes.
Yeah. So, but anyway, it's a beautiful story because it all unfolds in a very positive direction. Even though I had many doubts in my life early on about, worthy of love or not, if my mother had left me behind, et cetera. So, all those kind of challenges, but they were all met very beautifully through my near-death experience. And the big, big telling of that story.
Before we get to the near-death experience, which, as I said, I read your book, so I know that that's, you know, huge. Were your adoptive parents, so like me in this scenario, were they supportive of your searching? Like, how did they feel as you began that search? However, how old were you when you first started?
Well, I would say I was in my teens, mid-teens, when I would start writing letters to the children's home. They were supportive. I mean, you know, they had told us since the earliest we could remember, Gene and myself, that we were adopted. And there was nothing big, bad about it. In fact, they said we were chosen. That was the word they used. So that's a great word. You know, makes you feel maybe you're worthwhile.
Yeah.
But I think especially later on when my search got serious, I think my adoptive mother did feel a little threatened by the whole process. And I kept assuring her, you know, from my perspective, I really just had one family, and that was my family of origin that I grew up in. And that's still the way I feel. They're my family. I love my birth family.
I
got to meet my birth family.
You did. That's what I want to know. So So when you did the later reaching out, ultimately your birth mother said, okay.
Ultimately, but it's, you know, it was a long and arduous pathway. And in fact, I extend some of that story in the book, Living in a Mindful Universe. There's a lot more to my personal story in that which third book.
So I will be buying that book. I'm just saying, go ahead.
Yeah. So, but, you know, they were very supportive of many things in my life. But the interesting thing is for most of my life, I thought I might have a birth mother out there, but I thought my birth father just disappeared from the
scene. That's what you said.
And that's why it was so shocking in the year 2000. And all this is told in the book, Proof of Heaven. In the year 2000, when Evan was doing this school project on family genealogy, I got a phone call from the social worker where she basically said, your birth parents got married. And I cannot tell you what a shocker that was. My life thought that was a possibility. And she said, and they had three children. So I had a full biological family out there with siblings that I'd never known.
Oh, my goodness. Because it was the same mother and father.
Yeah. But then in that 2-minute phone call in the year 2000, I was also told they had lost the youngest daughter 2 years earlier in 1998, and they were still grieving her loss. So it was not a good time to come back in their lives.
Oh, no.
That was a very bad, bad downer. Led me into a dark night of the soul. And if you read adoption literature, you'll find that often happens to an adoptee who gets another rejection in adult life. It really sends them into a deep spin. Yeah. That's what happened to me.
Yeah. No, it's fascinating. My son, who's going to be 45, also, we adopted him at birth. And people probably have heard the story, but just to share how the universe works, my older son ended up, we did Lamaze, and they asked, did anybody want to have their birth filmed? Which we said, okay, I was very kind of a hippie and whatever. So we had the birth filmed, and then 4 years, I was trying to get pregnant again. I couldn't get pregnant. It was a whole, I was on fertility. And I don't know, finally, we started talking about adoption. And then all of a sudden, my husband's cousin called and said, you know, we know somebody and we know you're having trouble. Do you want to adopt? And we went, yeah, I think that's what we need to do. So Michael, my younger son, was due in the end of May. The woman was giving birth. I'm from Chicago. She was from California, came here to have the baby. And one day in June, we're still waiting for this birth to happen. We decide to watch the film of me giving birth to my older son, which we hadn't watched in, you know, 4 years, whatever. We just thought it. And we had Josh, who was 4 at that time, my older son. So we're all sitting watching me give birth and crying and happy and explaining to my older son how babies come to families in different way. I get a call an hour later that Michael was born while I'm at that exact time that I'm watching the movie. He was born. So
wow,
he knows that.
No accidents.
Exactly. So he knows that I feel that his soul could not come through me, but I was meant to be his mother. Now, interestingly, I've always been open. If he wants to search, you can. He doesn't, so far, seem to have any interest. I'm kind of curious, but he doesn't seem to have any interest. So everybody, I think, has a different way of how they deal with it when they're adopted. But it sounds like you had a yearning to find out. Then you finally find out both mom and dad, and they say no.
Right.
Ouch.
Yeah, that part was kind of tough. But, you know, the dark night of the soul is an important part of the journey.
Uh-huh.
Skepticism, true open-minded skepticism is essential at getting into the deepest truth here, you know. And in fact, I found when I came back from my journey, just as Rene Descartes said, he said, if you would view yourself as a true seeker sometime in your life, you must reject everything you've ever believed to be true. And that's what I had to do, was start over at square one.
Wow.
Because to me, the evidence that the brain does not create consciousness, and that our soul, our conscious awareness, is actually liberated at the time of physical death, is exactly what my NDE showed me in very powerful terms and in ways that the scientific community can understand fully. That's why the gift of a week-long coma due to severe gram-negative bacterial meningoencephalitis is so important.
Okay.
Because this mode of death really was not leaving any option for me to have dreams or hallucinations.
Right.
Okay. Because my brain was too damaged.
Okay. Let me interrupt. So before, most of my listeners may not know who you are. So part of what Eben is talking about is that he had this near-death experience. And from that, he had kind of an awakening. But I guess I just want to take one little step back. So previous to this, would you say that you had been, because I feel I've been a seeker since I'm 24 years old. I've always been looking and searching and what's my purpose and what am I doing and what's the meaning of life and is there something bigger out there? So that's been for like 50 years almost, always looking, searching. Would you say that you have been a seeker up until this near-death experience that you had? Were you always, because you're a scientist, so I don't know.
I would say in many ways, yes, I had been a seeker, and you're absolutely right. I'm a scientist first and foremost. So I had to explain it all through a scientific lens. And that remains the case, you know, in the 15 years since my coma. But that's why the medical parameters of the case are so important. There's a medical case report that three doctors not involved in my care wrote. It came out in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Diseases in September 2018. And it goes much further than I did in the book Proof of Heaven to show this brain was far too damaged to have any kind of dream or hallucination, much less this extraordinary experience. And not only that, how do you explain that recovery? The peer review editors of the journal challenged them, said, this case is unprecedented. You don't have people this sick from bacterial meningitis who then end up making a full recovery. How do you explain it? And they said, it's because he had a near-death experience. And they all knew, both the submitting authors and the peer review editors, they knew of other cases of miraculous healing and near-death experiences. So that actually allows you to start answering the bigger question of how did I have this incredible recovery?
Right. So again, just to kind of back up a little bit so the listener understands. So you were basically doing your doctor practice. Were you a professor or were you actually practicing medicine?
I was practicing. I moved from an academic setting at Harvard and UMass and other places, University of Virginia, down to Lynchburg, Virginia, to work in a private practice.
Okay.
That's what I was doing at that time.
Okay, so you were doing private practice. So you have kids, it sounds like. So raising a family and doing scientific stuff. And then all of a sudden, and then you were doing the search for your birth parents, and then they reject you, and that's depressing and upsetting. And then what were the symptoms of you getting sick? Because part of what I think Eben is trying to say here, and well, I know you are, is that this traumatic thing happened that was unexplainable, even from the scientists and the doctors, and he kind of awakened to see life in a whole different way, which has really pivoted you to kind of, because this is really about purpose and meaning, to change your course of how you're doing your life, both personally and professionally. And you did that kind of, if that was 20 years ago, you were in your 50s when this happened. So I always like, the reason why I love that part of people's stories is I don't always, and I've said this before, I don't feel, not always, I always do feel this, that anybody necessarily has one purpose or one path. I think that if you're open, life can give you a bunch of different paths. And if one thing seems like, you know, someone gets fired or they get divorced and they think my life is over, or even God forbid a spouse, whatever we all as humans have to face here on earth, there's always an opportunity for a pivot of something else that might be greater that we might not see at the time, but might help us find something even more meaningful or more purposeful. And we should be open to that. So let's go back in your story now. So you're in your 50s, you're doing now private practice, raising a family. Are you questioning the meaning of life? Or are you pretty happy with what you're doing? Or
I was quite content with what I was doing. And by the way, when I went into coma, I'd actually moved beyond that private practice job. I was back into an academic research job with a group called Focused Ultrasound Surgery Foundation based in Charlottesville. But I was heading up their global neurosurgical brain research aspect. I mean, using focused ultrasound of the brain. I was going around the world to different research centers to coordinate these research projects.
I don't know what you're thinking, listener, but he's so smart. So go ahead.
So anyway, but on November 10th, 2008, I woke up with severe back pain, headache, grand mal seizures, and then went deep into coma.
And you had not been sick at all. Just mostly healthy, 50-ish old male. Yeah. Everything was fine. You woke up with back pain and this other stuff. And then you just, were you rushed to the hospital or did?
Yeah, they, I mean, I was having seizures, trying to die right there at home. So they, the EMTs came to the house and hauled me off to the hospital where I worked. And in fact, the ER doctor who saw me at that point didn't even recognize me, even though we'd worked side by side.
Wow.
Many, many patients in that ER. But I was so destroyed by this illness, seizing and just in horrible shape, trying to die. And that's why it's such a mystery that I could spend those 7 days in deep coma. I have this profound spiritual experience that I explained in the book Proof of Heaven. And yet none of that should have been possible according to the modern tenets of neuroscience, because meningitis is a perfect model for human death. It destroys the outer surface of the brain. That's the part that makes us human. And mine was all lobes of my brain were affected. That's where this medical case report is so important. And that's why the case is so important to the scientific community, even though there is a, you know, an unscrupulous writer who, a would-be journalist who tries to promote that this is a medically induced coma, and not a meningitis coma, because he recognized how important that was to my story and why the scientific community takes that so seriously.
There's always doubters. So here's the thing that I just want to say. So for, I don't know how many out there are listening who know that there are many people that have a near-death experience and they say that they see a light and they see angels and God and whatnot. And there's a lot of like, oh yeah, you're probably just having a hallucination or a dream. And what Evan is about to tell us is that isn't the case for him at all, and probably for millions of others, because in his case, his physical malady, this meningitis, would not have allowed for a dream conscious state to even be happening because the brain was not at all functioning. So now you're in the coma for 7 days. And why don't you tell the listeners what happened during those 7 days for you?
Okay, I'll have to be a little brief because there's a lot that happened.
Okay.
And I'll point out
the Cliff Note version. Yes.
Yeah. An atypical feature of my coma that you don't find in other near-death experiences, but it was important for me to have the deepest understanding of my coma, is amnesia. I had no memories of Eben Alexander's life, so I couldn't go through an Eben Alexander life review and things like that.
Right,
that,
which often happens, or people report that, that they do a life review. Often so that wasn't your thing. That didn't happen to you.
Life reviews, but not from an Eben Alexander perspective.
Okay.
So briefly, because time is of the essence here, started in Earthworm's Eye View, very primitive course on responsive realm, like being in dirty jello, but I was rescued from that by this slowly spinning white light and a perfect musical melody that opened up like a rip in the fabric of that ugly Earthworm Eye View and led me into this brilliant ultra-real Gateway Valley. Now, this is where it's important to stress, as many near-death experiencers will tell you, it was much more real than this world.
Okay.
And this world is vague and murky and dreamlike compared to that. But part of the reason is, for example, when your life flashes before your eyes in this second level that I was in, the Gateway Valley, it's a timeless realm. It's where people can experience birth, death, everything in between, past lives, future lives, all of that, your giant soul line. You start to witness this incredible scene that makes far more sense because of the grand scale of it all. Far beyond the little ego perspective that where we live these little lives. But we have a higher soul available to us. The key is you're to escape the tyranny of that little teeny voice in your head, your ego mind.
Exactly.
Recognizing that your conscious awareness is part of a much bigger soul.
Totally.
Before we'll be here again, and is a much grander prospect for evolution, for purpose, for meaning, for understanding. All of that becomes much clearer in that timeless, eternal realm, like in the Gateway Valley. Now, in that realm, I was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing, millions of other butterflies looping and spiraling in vast formations, thousands of beings dancing in the meadow down below, lots of joy and merriment, children playing, dogs jumping. It was all being fueled because up above were these swooping orbs of angelic choirs, emanating chants, anthems, hymns that would thunder through my awareness and awaken this incredible passion for life and love and existence that is part of our spiritual reality. And the best part, I wasn't alone on the butterfly wing. Beautiful young woman, sparkling eyes, high forehead, high cheekbone.
Nice to have a little partner. Yeah.
So anyway, the guardian angel, spiritual guide, whatever you want to call her, if I had scripted all this, that would have been my adoptive father. He died 4 years before my coma, but he was nowhere to be seen in all of this journey. That's part of the power of the amnesia and the fact that instead of finding him, who I would have scripted this to be.
Yeah.
I found this other guardian angel who I didn't know. And yet we had this mind meld deep in the journey where mm-hmm. her awareness came to me in my own mind. She didn't have to say a word. Her knowing, you are deeply loved and cherished forever. You have nothing to fear. You are richly loved and cared for. And that was, I cannot tell you how reassuring and affirming that was in that moment. And those who've read the book Proof of Heaven will realize that that guardian angel proved to be very important 4 months post-coma when I received a picture in the mail. And all of that is linked to my adoption and birth family history. But wow, was it an oh my God moment when I made the connection of who that beautiful guardian angel was months later. So anyway,
who was that?
To very quickly finish off, I ascended to higher and higher levels. Yeah. I remember seeing all of that spiritual realm collapsing down till I was in the core, a complete unity of oneness with that God force. That's where so many near-death experiencers come to see there's nothing to fear about dying. It's an expansion of consciousness, not a constriction. And I actually came to recognize the very source of conscious awareness was that God force of pure love at the core of the universe. That's the case for all of us. And that pure love is really kind of the direction this revolution in consciousness can take us.
You're going to love my quote today. I end everything with a quote. And so you're going to love what I picked out today. Go ahead.
Excellent. So anyway, but all of this, many, many things happening, many lessons. But at the end of it all, yes. as they told me, I was not there to stay. And when I tried to conjure up the musical notes of the melody again, after multiple falls back into this earthworm eye view and then a sense back through the spiritual realms, it no longer worked. And to say I was sad would be an understatement, but I also knew by then I could trust that I would be taken care of. And that's when I saw thousands of beings going off into the distance. And that's what I interpreted as the power of prayer. They were kind of drawing back here.
Okay.
That's very more fully explained in the book. And then the final scene of my 7-day coma was when I saw 6 faces that would bubble up out of the muck, say a few words and disappear. I didn't understand the language because my amnesia was still in effect. But it was those faces that helped me to know that the vast majority of the coma journey happened between days 1 and 5 or 1 and 6. 1 in 4, 1 in 5 of the 7-day coma. I explained all that timing in Proof of Heaven, but ultimately that's when I started coming back to this world. And it was the last phase. It was my son Bond. That's the one that drew me back to this world. I didn't recognize him at the time. That was day 7 of coma. They kept Bond from the worst news during that week. But now they had a family conference saying I'd gone from 10% chance of survival to 2%, no chance of recovery. And it was time to let me go. Take me off the ventilator, stop the 3 powerful antibiotics, let me go. Bond knew that was horrible news, came running down the hallway, pleading with me, Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay.
How old was he?
He was 10 years old at the time.
Wow.
And
so when you woke up.
And I came back to this world. Now, when I first did, my brain was still wrecked. But I remember my sister Phyllis told me much later that it was really odd that spend this whole week around my body on that ventilator expecting me to die. And then when I'm waking up, within 20 minutes, I'm sitting there on the bed looking at everybody, doctor, nurse, family, look them in the eyes. And I would say, don't worry, all is well. And then on to the next.
Amazing story. Amazing. So you woke up. And you remembered all of this, obviously, and felt, and then you felt like I've got to write about this. I've got to like you knew that you had to bring this message out to the world. Was that part of what was happening?
That was a huge point. Now, important to point out, when I was first waking up there those first few days, all I remembered was where I'd just been. My amnesia was still very powerful. I had no memories of my life before, so I didn't even recognize my mother, my sisters, my sons when I first woke up.
Wow.
No idea who these beings were. I mean, need to understand how badly damaged my brain was, but it was coming back very, very rapidly and had full recovery of memories within about 2 months. Everything.
Wow.
Even better.
Did you have
than
to go through like
the coma.
Did you have to go to like to physical therapy to learn how to walk or anything? All that.
I did. I had a lot of balance troubles, coordination issues. I mean, I really went through the ringer on this, but within 2 months was back completely to normal.
Unbelievable. You know,
with some enhancements, which normally come from
so
a narrative.
When you start here, you are this neuroscientist and, you know, I'm picturing, I mean, my brother passed away, but he's probably listening now. So I'll just say hi, Jer. But, you know, he was a scientist. And so, again, he was a doctor and I've been on the spiritual journey my whole life. So when he got sick and, you know, you think about the law of the universe, he had a brain tumor and then he ended up with leukemia. And the only way for him to survive was if he had a bone marrow transplant. And I was the 100% match. So we went to Houston, we had he was very funny. So after the bone marrow transplant, you know, he's in isolation and I go down to see him and he wants to make sure I'm okay and whatever. And he goes, I think I want to have my nails done because my bone marrow was going in there. Yeah, he's a comedian. But so when he first got diagnosed, I brought him a bunch of books of spiritual people. And he just, you know, never really got on board kind of with that. So here I'm seeing you, this brilliant scientist, having this kind of woo-woo out there experience. And you come back to your community and you know that you have to pass this message along. How did your family, how did your coworkers, how did colleagues, did they think you'd lost your mind or like, what was the feedback?
Well, you know, there could be some out there who thought I lost my mind, who just disappeared from my life. That's possible. But the vast majority of them were very supportive. And not only that, but I started getting a lot of new communications, friends, contacts, an active investigation with scientists all around the world. I didn't realize that there were hundreds of scientists working on this afterlife question. And really? In fact, right now, all of your viewers are very lucky because those scientists all work together to contribute 28 essays. If you go to BigelowInstitute.org,
okay.
That was a contest held in 2021, and they were originally, the question was, what's the best scientific evidence for continuation of consciousness after permanent bodily death? The question was asked by Robert Bigelow, an aerospace engineer in Las Vegas. His son had committed suicide. He wanted to know, what's the scientific proof of all this? Originally, they were going to give out 3 monetary awards. They ended up giving out 28 monetary awards because the essays were that good. Every scientist who submitted an essay had to demonstrate at least 5 years of active, serious experience investigating the afterlife question. And in that context, they had these 28 essays submitted. They're available for free right now to all of your readers. BigelowInstitute.org. You will not doubt the reality of the afterlife and of reincarnation again once you read these scientific papers.
I love it because, again, having been on this path and I believe in all this stuff, and I see, here's part of what I love interviewing or talking to someone like you, because you have scientific. So I feel I am I'm a soul here in an earthly body, but I also feel my feet are on the ground. So I've been a practicing psychotherapist for 40 years, but, you know, people, I hope they respect me and whatever. And so some think I might be a little kooky, but they think, well, she's kind of smart and she, you know, looks normal and acts normal in the world. And so I find that I've gone to so many, whatever, psychics and numerologists, whatever, that are, I don't know what you want to call them. They're just like weird. That's all I can, it's rude and I shouldn't be judgmental, but whatever. But so when I find someone like you who's a scientist and that you have other colleagues that are researching this so that there's a scientific base. So it's not just like a feeling that I have inside, or I've had, so many, like with my son and the birth, so many things of synchronicity that go way beyond, like, is it really a coincidence? Could it be that something bigger is in out there that's there to help us? So I love that it's scientific. So on that note, I want to ask another question. And if this feels beyond whatever, just tell me. But, you know, I feel like our world and our country is right now not really doing that great. So from your own scientific experience of what the spiritual world is saying, like, why are us human beings, we're just not really getting along that well? Do any thoughts on that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And what I'm talking about is the cure for that very problem. The
Which
problem
is love.
You're talking about is materialism, physicalism,
yes.
Pretending the brain creates consciousness,
right.
And that only the physical world exists. In fact, that materialist science would scoff at you if you claim to have free will, because they'd say, no, it's all chemical reactions and electron fluxes in the substance of the brain that gives you an illusion of consciousness, illusion of free will, but nothing is going on here other than the laws of physics, chemistry, biology applied to the physical matter of my brain and body and of this world around me. And that's where they're really missing the point, because ultimately it's more about the perceptions. And the world of quantum physics has forced us over the last century to admit the primacy of consciousness and the awarding of the Nobel Prize in Physics for entanglement in the year 2022. Entanglement is that very bizarre, spooky action at a distance that Einstein always denied. And yet every one of the experiments done since the 1970s on has proven that spooky action at a distance is true and not Einstein's version, which was what he called hidden variables, which would have preserved this kind of local realism universe that we're talking about. But that's not the case. So to even begin to understand quantum physics and the deep mystery it offers, one needs to understand this is all about the brain-mind connection and the nature of reality, you know, not just what we can measure physically, but all the things that occur in a human being's life has to do with the spiritual reality of our existence.
So
and
the
ultimately, what the science is telling us is that we're all connected through that mental space. So we have shared meaning, purpose, and existence through this kind of one mind, this idealism going to panentheism, kind of the God force being in all that is. That's the scientific position.
So starting to win in play. More kind of simplistic. So when you're saying, so the cure or whatever you want to call it to get us all getting along a little bit better is to change our perception, like that we're...
It's to acknowledge these facts of life. The facts of life are when people die, they have these extraordinary experiences where they reunite with souls of departed loved ones, not imaginary. This is real. And not only that, but they have access to the minds of loved ones still incarnate, could be thousands of miles away. So it's all through that mental realm. And that's why meditation, centering prayer are so important.
There we go. Okay. Do you know Suzanne Giesemann?
Sure. We've presented with her multiple times.
Yeah, I love her. I just listened to all her
great.
Stuff.
She's a wonderful person.
Yeah. She's another one that was a fighter pilot and in the Navy and what, I don't know if she's a fighter pilot, but she was in the Navy and whatever. And then all of a sudden had this horrible thing happened with her stepdaughter and was devastated. And then she started researching this. Another person who's very, her first half of her life, very feet on the ground, Army, Navy, whatever she was in, and then has gone off into this other realm. So you're saying, just for, to make it a little more simplistic, I don't know that my listeners or even myself are going to examine quantum physics. Not that I don't believe you, but it's really about trusting that we're all connected and that the real purpose here is for us to love. And that when we're not doing that, we're going to have a lot of trouble. And if you'd have some faith that we're here having an experience to have our soul grow and be loving and make this world a better place. I think that's kind of what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, the deep lesson of near-death experiences scientifically studied is that we're all in this together. Those life reviews, your life flash before your eyes, when you study thousands of those reports, you find that that life review is from everybody's perspective. It's not from your personal perspective. Mm-hmm. So if you hand out pain and suffering to others or greedy and selfish, that feels badly to those people around you. And that's what you get to witness during your life review. You become them to feel from their perspective. And so the life review is the golden rule. Treat others as you would like to be treated, written into the very fabric of the universe. Okay. And that's why it's so important to get, because we find as people are in the dying process, they find that the only thing that matters is how much love and care they handed out for their fellow beings. Mm-hmm. And so if you've been doing other things, you've been wasting your time, essentially. And this is all of, and so the science of near-death experiences fully supports that we're all in this together through that binding force of love. And we're really here to care for each other. And it doesn't get simpler than that. And that's where the evidence leads. All the evidence leads there. It doesn't lead us back to the bleak and paltry fiction of materialism and that false sense of separation and that crazy, pseudo-Darwinian concept of competition as being important. Biologists will tell you it's not competition. It's collaboration and cooperation.
Love it.
Members of the species and between species. That's what leads to biological success. And so all of this is coming together in the modern scientific understanding of near-death and related experiences to show us we're all truly in this together. And it's that binding force of love that ultimately brings us together.
I love it. So if this has been fascinating. Beyond, you're like so filled with information, and I love your passion that, and that like you feel so strongly, and you've got the science behind it. So it's not like a hokey pokey kind of a thing. Like you got the goods, buddy. Okay. So if someone's listening to this and they're struggling and they feel like I'm just not on my path and I don't feel happy and I feel like I'd like to do something else, but I might not have as nice a house if I have to change a career, or I might be alone if I feel like this partner isn't what I want. But they know they want to change. They know that there's something else in them that would probably be better and more fulfilling. Any just short?
Yes. Very
suggestion.
Easily, quickly, take a little time out each day for meditation or centering prayer, going within,
yep.
Putting the little ego voice, which uses fear and anxiety as its tools.
Exactly.
You can ask a question, make an intention, but then put that into timeout. And the tool that I use and I highly recommend is Sacred Acoustics. If you want to find more, go to sacredacoustics.com. There's a free 20-minute off download. Listen through headphones. You'll see what I mean. And we discuss all this in our book, Living the Mindful Universe, how powerful these techniques can be using differential frequency brainwave entrainment in the form of Sacred Acoustics or whatever form you have of going deep within. But take a little time each day for that, to get a break from the ego mind, and also to get in touch with kind of your higher soul, the part of you that's connected with all others. I often do a lot of higher soul to higher soul work in meditation.
Me too.
When I'm dealing with someone and we're having some kind of conflict, to get to resolution, I go for the best and highest good for all involved through this higher soul to higher soul work.
You're like speaking my language. I literally say to my clients, literally, do you think that's to your highest good? Is that really what your highest self wants to do when they're in conflict and they want to go yell at someone? Or I have someone that's, I'm going to write that email and tell them off. I go, are you though? Are you really going to do that? Like, how is that really going to help? So I love that. So my listeners know I meditate almost every day. The one that I've been listening to lately, I think her thing is called Great Meditations, and she does 10-minute meditations. They're all free, and you just Google Great Meditations. She's got the most spiritual, beautiful voice. I myself can't sit long and listen to those sounds and just go breathe, and because the mind, I just can't quiet. I've tried and tried. So I do always guided meditations, and it always, I literally have Googled spiritual meditations to meet my guides, or I want a message from my guides. So here's just a little anecdote that just happened. So, and I journal also. And so when I journal, I don't go, dear high HS, higher self or higher soul. So everyone knows who listens to this. I have these gastro problems and it's very annoying. And I want to eat what I want and I don't want to have any problems. So I had a bad episode about 2 weeks ago. I write to my higher self. I go, listen, can you just give me one more something? I know you've given me a lot of things and sometimes I listen, sometimes I don't. So I said, so anything new that you might have to offer, I'm open to listening to. That day I go have a manicure. My regular manicurist, I goofed and went to someone else, a new person who I'd never met before. And I was having a bad day. And I say to her, you know, I might during this manicure have to run to the bathroom. And so she goes, well, what's going on? I don't even know this person. She gives me, she's from Ukraine or Russia. She says, I got this stuff. It's sold at the Russian pharmacy, but you take a teaspoon of it with a glass of water and it calms your stomach down. I went, okay. I did email to my regular doctor. This is what I'm saying. I think you can be Eastern and Western together. He looked it up and said, it doesn't seem like it'd be any harm. I took it that day. I don't want to say I've taken it two other times. It's like a miracle thing. And I just go, thank you. Now that doesn't mean I can still eat all the sugar I want. I can't, God darn it. But, I just think it was crazy that I wrote that in the morning, had the manicure 3 hours later with a different person. So I just go, thank you. I always say thank you. And so to be aware that if you do what you're saying, which I agree, and you are quiet and listen and just wait, you don't know where that answer might come from, but it will come if you believe. And I believe.
Right. So. Well, it does. And that's why I think it's important to point out the binaural beats, the sacred acoustics are very important tool because they're actually interacting with your brain in the lower brain stem. And every sound you may have ever heard that like a chant, anthem, hymn that might have contributed to a transcendental state was processed up in the temporal lobes in the acoustic cortex and circuits that have come about in the last 2 to 3 million years. That's very different from the circuits processing those differential frequency brainwaves of sacred acoustics. They're being processed in a 300 million year old circuit in the lower brainstem. And I think that's one of the reasons why sacred acoustics gives such a profound ability to separate from the here, now, and sense of self and allow conscious awareness to get into that hypnagogic space between awake and asleep, but a place where you can really come to identify kind of that higher soul and connection with primordial mind.
Well, I believe you. And I love when you start throwing in these, you know, $10 million words that I have no idea what they mean. But I get the gist that these other, and here's what's funny. I think it was, it was the last person we interviewed, Noah, also is also a PhD and scientist. It was Chris Nyber, I think. And he too said almost the same thing, that our brain, our left brain is like, it's old fashioned. It's like we need a new, it's like we have a, I said, oh, like a BlackBerry. He goes, oh, millions of years old. I was trying to get a visual concept. And that our right brain, and he gave like a scientific example also, is really more about soul and what we feel and getting to that higher place. So probably these acoustics would work. All right. I believe you. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you so much for doing this. I'm going to end with a quote that I think fits right into this. And I just can't tell you how much I appreciate your knowledge and your passion about this and your story. I think it's like unbelievable. And I'm going to get your newest book too. Okay. So here's what I knew that you had this near death. So it wasn't just totally random. I believe love is why we're here on this planet and that ultimately it's our purpose for our life. They say people who've had near-death experiences often report back that at the end of our lives, we have a life review and we're asked one question. And the question is, how much did you love?
Right.
So that's
beautiful.
It's that simple. It's just, who was this? This was Marcy Shimoff wrote that. I don't know who that is. But I think that's a beautiful way to end because that's really what it is. Everybody, it's about love.
Well,
and
it is. That's where this world succeeds. And
exactly,
the individual succeeds is by sharing the love.
Right. And that's when people have, you know, are saying, but look at the state of the world in our country, whatever, I go, here's what I can do. I can be in a place of love and send out love. And right. Don't think that isn't powerful, because it is. So if we each could do that, do our best in our interpersonal relationships that we're in right now, just be in a place of love. And when you do that prayer and meditation, send it back out into the world.
Absolutely.
So thank you.
Very well put. Thank you, Janice.
Love it. Thank you, Evan. All right. This is Janice Alpert. Thank you for listening to On Purpose and hoping that you're doing your life with purpose and maybe even on purpose. Till next time. Bye-bye.